get an idea of who we are by what we hear other people tell us about ourselves. Now, as adults, we can make some changes, but most of us still keep on with that I am who somebody tells me about me, without realizing that we can make the step over and begin to change. Another one of Calvin and Hobbes that I don't have blown up says, Calvin is saying, Mom and Dad say I should make my life an example of the principles I believe in. He goes on walking. But every time they do, they tell me to stop. Hobbes says, I'm not sure that total self-indulgence is really a principle. And that may be something we want to work on too. What's the difference between that person that says, boy, I'm the important one and nobody else matters, and somebody who says, I'm a worthwhile human being. I'm a child of God. I'm okay. Here's another one from For Better or For Worse, Lynn Johnston. Do you have that in yours? She's a Canadian. Yeah. And I could do whole courses on just Lynn Johnston's cartoon. She's marvelous. This is a while ago when Michael and Lizzie were younger, and Lizzie sticking her head out the window, sticking her tongue out at Michael and his friend. And Michael says, Ma, Lizzie's making faces at us through the window. Mother comes out the door and says, Michael, you're too old to let a four-year-old get the best of you. And Michael says with tears, I'm not letting her get the best of me. This is the worst of me. And sometimes we don't realize the difference, that we have some choices there. Another cartoon that I like. And this is a woman talking to some friends in a group, and she says, I live with a very dear friend, me. Now, how many of us can say that? I hope that we all can, and that we really feel that. How many of you ever been on an airplane? Anyone who's not been on an airplane? Okay, what's the little patter they give when you're getting ready to take off, before you get the taxi down the runway? What's that little about the seat belt and about this and the exit doors? And then what do they say if the air pressure goes on the plane? And you need to use the oxygen. Do you remember what they say? If you're traveling, yes. If you're traveling with somebody who's disabled or with a child, put the oxygen mask on yourself first and then put it on your child. Well, that's hardly being responsible, is it? Or is it? Think about that. So often we do things the other way. I've got to do something for somebody else, because if I do it for myself first, what will they think? And yet, what's the reason why air flight attendants have you put on your mask first and then put on the child's mask?
So that you're capable of looking after the child.
That's right. What if while you're putting that mask on the child or the disabled person, they start to fight and won't allow you to do it? What might happen? You might run out of oxygen before you can get it on them, and then both of you are out. So if you can take care of yourself, you're much better able to take care of another person. Jean Ilsley Clark has two neat books on self-esteem. This one is from the library. The second one is also in the library, but it's out right now. It is in the bookstore. Both of them are in the bookstore. Her earlier book, in about 87 or so, was Self-Esteem, a Family Affair. And in about 89, she wrote Growing Up Again, parenting ourselves and our children. And she does some great things in that. And one of the pieces that I like, and unfortunately we don't have enough time to really go through it, is a section that she has from pages 116 to pages 134, and that she deals with the seven stages of self-esteem development that began from birth on up to adulthood. But one of the neat things that she talks about self-esteem, the way we feel about ourselves, the way we encourage ourselves, the confidence we have in ourselves, the worth that we feel that's about us, that's basically what self-esteem is all about. How do I feel about the me that is? And she looks at the various stages of self-esteem development from birth on up to adulthood. And part of the good news that she brings to this is that self-esteem is something you can continually recycle. And you may decide, in her last section on adulthood, she gives some indications of there of needs for me to grow up again. She does that throughout the whole thing. In fact, as you look through it, there are 8 different parts to each stage. So in the very first one, on stage 1, which is on being, how do I begin to understand who I am myself? And sometimes we're still doing that as adults, trying to figure out, who am I? And that's okay. We can recycle. There's nothing wrong with having to recycle. It's just a reminder. It's a renewal. It's an encouragement to ourselves. But she divides each stage into 8 different parts. The very first one gives a little bit of information, very basic, on the developmental tasks of that stage. What's really important for the child or the adult to gain at that stage? Section 2 are some basic characteristics. What are basic patterns, basic activities that kids do? Typical behaviors of the child for that stage. Stage 3 are some affirmations. How do we affirm a child? For instance, in stage 1 on being, one of the affirmations is, I'm glad you are alive. You belong here. I love, and this is one that's awfully hard to say at 4 o'clock in the morning when you've been up at 12 and at 2 and at 3 and at 4. It says, I love you and I care for you willingly. Now, we may have to will ourselves to say that. But anyway, to even say it, because it's a reminder to yourself that I knew this wasn't going to be a rose garden when I decided to have children, that my sleep might be disturbed. And I love you and I care for you willingly. Number 4 in each of these stages is some helpful parent behaviors. And stage 5 is some unhelpful parent behaviors, things that we might try not to do. That deals with the child at that particular stage. And numbers 6, 7, and 8 deal with the adult who's going through that stage again, as we try to remind ourselves that I'm glad I'm here. I'm glad I'm alive. And number 6 in each stage is clues to a need for adults to grow up again. How can I remind myself of these? Nothing wrong. It's not saying you're bad. It's not saying you're an idiot or disabled or whatever. It's just a reminder and a renewal. Hey, I've forgotten about this. There are so many things to remember. It's good to be reminded. And then if we discover some clues that I might want to reaffirm my being at an adult stage, I can look at some activities that support my growing up again in this stage, whatever it happens to be. And number 8 for each stage is changing those affirmations that were in number 3 to apply to me. And for instance, I'm glad I am alive. I belong here. I love and care for myself and willingly love and care, accept love and care from others. So it's a reminder that love and care is two ways. It's not just I've got to give it to somebody else, or somebody else has to give it to me, and if they don't give it to me, I'm just empty. But I can also give it to myself. I can support myself. I can encourage myself. So we want to begin in some of our 8 basic skills with a very simple 5 letters, IALAC, that stands for I am lovable and capable. It's a name tag you all wear, whether you know it or not, believe it or not, accept it or not. It's there as a gift from your creator. Have you ever seen these little signs that say, God doesn't make junk? Remember that. You aren't junk. No one is. When my husband and I were doing marriage enrichment program at a church in one of the previous locations in which we lived, there was a group of middle-aged people. And we had little name tags that had IALAC on the bottom of them, and they wrote their first names on the top. And as we began, we said, do you have any idea what the IALAC stand for? Blank faces. I'm not sure anyone even cared what they stood for. And all of a sudden, there was one gentleman whose mouth began to turn up, and you could begin to see these twinkles coming by his eyes. And he said, I know what it stands for. It stands for I am Lutheran and cuddly. I like that too, and I think that's appropriate also. So we want to look at positive. One parent in a parenting class said, I know it's standing for I'm losing all control. No, it doesn't stand for that. We want to look at it positively. How can we support ourselves? So I'm loving and caring, I'm lovable and capable, I'm Lutheran and cuddly. Fill in the blank, whatever you want to, positively. We've got enough negative things going on in our life. We don't need to add to them. So in a sense, we're becoming what God has meant us to be. We are in process. We are God's child. How we think about ourselves has a real impact. When we were in another community, and my husband was a chaplain at a university, there was one young woman who was really quite a good student at the university, who on several occasions throughout number of years of knowing her, and it was about 4 or 5 years, she would give us a call at about 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock in the morning and ask my husband to come and pick her up at a certain street corner by a telephone booth, and ask if he would take her to Upstate Medical Center, which had a psychiatric inpatient center, which is just on the other side of the university. And she lived with an uncle who wouldn't allow her to use the telephone in the house, but which had been a pattern in her, the home in which she grew up. She was not allowed, no one in her family except her father was allowed to use the telephone. Her father was a professional. And he would on various occasions call home to see if anybody would answer the phone, and if they did, he would blast him. That phone is only for me to use, and you, even if he wasn't there, it was for him to use. That gives you a bit of an idea of the family in which she grew up. She would check herself in for a couple of weeks, and then get back some strength again and come back up, make up her classes, and did fairly well in her as a student. And one time I was at the home of a mutual friend, a single parent who had 4 children, and this young woman was often a support system to this single parent friend who was doing graduate work herself. And one day she came into the house when I was at our mutual friend's, and she had just come from an hour with her psychiatrist, which at that point she was doing daily. And she came in and she said, now, and she had attempted suicide. Each time she called us, it was an attempt to avoid committing suicide. She knew that she was losing it, and she would decide she needed to go to a safe place before she did something to herself. And she said to us, now I know why I really am not supposed to be alive. Shocked. Why I wasn't ever supposed to be born, why I shouldn't be living. What did you find out? I mean, that's a shocking statement. And she said, I just discovered that I was not a planned child. I was not a wanted child. I was unplanned. I happened. Whereupon our mutual friend burst out laughing, and I looked over at her and I thought, she's working on her master's in public health nursing. I mean, you've got a lot of smarts. What are you doing bursting out laughing? And she realized we were both standing there with shocked looks on our faces. And she said, oh, excuse me, that probably was very inappropriate. But I was just thinking that I have 4 children and 3 out of the 4 were unplanned, but I can't remember which one was. She said, but I would never, ever tell any of the children that they were unplanned. Or if they ever found it out through some other means or others, that I'm glad they're here and they are meant to be here. And you are meant to be here. That what happened back producing your birth is something very different. And now that you're here, you have a responsibility, she went on to say, to do something with your life. And to give something back. All those years when people told you things about yourself are in the past, and you can believe them, accept them or not accept them. But now you also have some other choices, and you can make some decisions for yourself. And you can say, I am lovable and capable. I am worthwhile. I am okay. I am a child of God. I belong here. And I have some abilities to give. So how do we accept ourselves with whatever gifts and limitations we have and say, I will use them to the best of my ability? Now, I may have had a lot of people somewhere back there saying, you again. Can't you ever do anything right? You are so pokey, so slow. I have to do everything over again whenever you start it. We may have, you are dumb, you are whatever, fill in the blank. We may have heard variations of those. How do we work ourselves into being strong enough to say, that was what somebody else decided for me at some other time for whatever reason. Now I can make some changes and I can do something. I have some gifts. I may not have all the gifts I need to have, but I have some gifts that I can offer. And I'll gain a few others because we're constantly growing. We don't stop. Progress is a womb to tomb process. We're constantly learning from the beginning to the end. So, if we have a sense of feeling okay about ourselves, we're more willing to do some things. Let's just do some brainstorming. If you feel okay about yourself, what are some of those things that you're more able to do?
Take a risk.
Take a risk, yes. Otherwise you say, oh, I'm not going to bother. If I don't do it, I can't accept another failure. So I'm not even going to try. But look at all that we might miss out on if we decide to not try. Okay, so we might be willing to take a few more risks. What else?
Give and share, because you've got something to give and share.
That's right. And give and share and even receive. That it's okay to receive. I don't have to always just go out, oh, no, don't do it for me. Don't you know people like that? My grandmother was in her 80s, and when our daughters and my husband and I would go to visit her in Minneapolis, my grandmother and grandfather, she would have this big meal prepared for us and sit down, eat. And we said, Mother, Grandma, sit down and join us. No, I can't eat. I mean, she would never sit down. She was always constantly running, finding something else for us. And I wanted to have her sit down and join us. My grandfather would, but my grandmother was always the dutiful servant. She worked hard before, and now it's time to sit down. But that was what she had defined for herself. Okay, if I feel okay about myself, I'm more able to do what else?
Do things that are good for us and help our growth.
Yes, then I can spend a bit of time with myself. How many of you have heard of the book on the one-minute manager? Is it Spencer Johnson? I've meant to bring that down and it's still up on my desk. He's also written a couple of others. I mean, he discovered that 1 minute, I mean, there are about 80 pages, 90 pages, people can read them quickly and they sell very well, so he did 1 minute manager, 1 minute mother, 1 minute father. He didn't do a parent, he did a mother and a father, so you have to buy both. 1 minute teacher, but he also did 1 minute for myself. And saying, how do we take that time to encourage ourselves so that we feel more refreshed to go out and do what else we need to do? Think about that. What is it I need to do to help myself feel okay today? What do I need to do for myself that will help me then feel more capable of helping someone else? And tomorrow we're going to be today we're looking at taking care of me. Tomorrow we'll look at taking care of thee and we. Because sometimes people are very uncomfortable saying, oh, but that's too self-centered, just taking care of yourself. Well, there's a first step and there's a second step. I don't want to build up just egotistical people, but I want to build up wholeness and healthiness. Okay. If I feel okay, I'm more likely to be happy, to share that happiness, be contagious to other people, not in the virus that's going around, but in happiness and feeling okay, and it's a great day. Even if it's cloudy and raining and you can't take the hike, there are other things you can do today. Great people to meet and talk to. Okay. So, look at, if I like myself, try to answer that for yourself, and where will you go? Got one piece of homework for you that I think is very helpful, and if you do it at least once a day for 30 days, you'll see miracles happen. And that is, it doesn't take any memberships or special clothing or being in special places, and it doesn't take much time. You can do it in about 5 seconds max. And we're going to practice it. So hold your hand up in front of your face, and we'll use our imagination if we're kids. If we're kids, that's a mirror. Pretend it's a mirror, and so look at it, wiggle your nose, and see how you look as you're here. Okay, everyone's going to look at their own hand, so you won't have to worry about whoever else is looking at you. And while you're looking at that hand mirror that's in front of you, stop for a moment and go to yourself and say, I'm okay. Okay, let's try it once again. Okay? I'm okay. Now, if you feel, I have every one of my classes do that, whether it happens to be in self-esteem or happens to be in parenting or happens to be in anger, because I think it all begins with how I feel about myself. And they all say, no way, can't do that. What would the rest of my family think? Maybe they think I'd gone crazy. Well, invite them in to join you. Tell them that that's something they can do. Or close the door and do a closet kiss. I mean, if you don't want anybody else to see you. How do we affirm ourselves? I mean, that's one very, very little tiny thing you can do to say you're okay. You can kiss somebody else too if you want to, but you can also start by kissing yourself. Okay, so that kind of label, recognizing that we are okay, that we are a child of God, and God doesn't make junk. Number two, you are in charge of how you feel. Now, so often we've given that power away. We've talked about this in the anger class. We've given the power away, and we let other people have the remote control to our feelings, or we pretend to be the puppet, and somebody up there, certainly not God, is pulling the strings because she wouldn't do that to us. But that we have a responsibility to own our own feelings. Feelings aren't right or wrong, they're okay. It's how we choose to act on it that becomes judgeable as being okay or helpful or not helpful. But all feelings are okay, and that we have some choice as to how we're going to respond to them. It's not what other people say or do to me that really determines how I feel. It's more that filter system it goes through when it goes through in one ear and up the other, if that's the way you want to think about it. It's that filter system that has me think about it. It's what I say to myself after they stop talking. So think about how much responsibility you have for your feelings. Now, that doesn't mean that we can then go around and hurl nasty things at other people because they shouldn't. I mean, they know better. They don't have to accept it. I mean, we still have a responsibility not to be cruel and crude and unkind to other people. We can also filter out those things that other people say to us when they may not be thinking about being crude or cruel and say, I'm not going to let that stick. I don't agree with that, so I'm just going to let it stay to the side. We used to have a friend who has since died, who had the most sarcastic sense of humor. He was a marvelous person. And I can remember feeling just crushed and hurt when we went to, it was a family friend of Paul's parents, and we were visiting the family, and he came to have a meal with us, and he looked at our little daughter, our first child, our prize possession, who is very bright, and we thought, you know, would master all things, and she has pretty well. And he said, oh dear, oh, I can tell that look. I know. If you have any trouble getting her into a school for the mentally disabled, just call on me, and I'll pull strings, and I'll get her right into the one. It's so sad that an adorable little child like her shouldn't have a brain in her head. Oh, you must be just beside. And he went on, and I thought, what in this world is this guy doing? And I finally decided, I'm not going to listen to it. I think I ended up turning around and walking out. Probably ready in tears. And I thought, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. That is not funny in any way. And sometime later, when I felt I knew him a little bit better, both Paul and I were able to say, you know, I really feel uncomfortable when you use joking as a put down, or put downs as joking. I'm not sure which way it's supposed to be. But I really don't like it. And he really did stop, at least around us. But how do we take charge of how we feel? So we began to recognize that he was going to say a lot of things to us that we were just going to have to like pass through the filter without stopping it at all, without straining anything seriously. That's just the way Jack responds to people. That's the humor he has. I'm not going to buy into it. It's others don't make me feel stuff. I choose how I decide to feel. I'm trying to say, we just got a message through in the village last night that Paul's mother at age 93 died on Wednesday. I think both of us feel a great sense of relief in saying, she has been saying for so many years, I'm waiting for the gates of glory to open. And now they're opened. And in the last 6 months, we have not really been able to understand her. And she has not been able to walk. And in the last couple of months, she has stopped eating. So that we knew before, and the memorial service has already been, Paul already set that up, and the brothers and sister have copies of it, and the decisions have been made, and that she'll be cremated, and the memorial service will be at the end of July when we're back, because we have a daughter in Scotland, and we have a daughter in France right now. And they're not back until the 20-something of July, and we're not back until the 25th of July. And I think we can feel a sense of sadness and a sense of loss. You know, that's owning our own feelings. But not a sense of tragedy. She's lived a very full and a very energetic life and has not been able to do it in the last 9 months. And so this is not the way she wanted to be. She was always out there, vigorous. She was on her church worship committee at age 85 and doing things. And so I think it's been a kind of relief and, you know, take ownership of our feelings and to say, thank God that there's no more suffering in this. Taking ownership of our feelings rather than, oh, why? So others don't make me feel. I can choose to a certain extent. I mean, we can certainly be surprised and it comes up and shocks us. But we always have a choice in what we're going to do about it. If we know we have that choice and if we've done some thinking, and if we aren't able to choose, then maybe we need to take some time outs and figure it out, get back into thinking again. When we respond to somebody else saying, oh, you hurt me, it's not because they've said something damaging to us, it's because we're probably already hurting inside and it just brings it to blossom. And our responsibility is then to go in and clean that up and not blame the other person for triggering it. To take responsibility for our feelings. There's a lot of things that we're saying that can empower us, how I respond inside, and to remember, Eleanor Roosevelt a long time ago said, no one can make you feel inferior without your permission. No one can make you feel outraged without your permission. Nobody can make you feel embarrassed without your permission. So we need to take responsibility for those things that we're feeling. Henry Ford also said, if you think you can or you think you can't, you're right. Think about that. If you think you can, you can. If you think you can't, you probably can't. What you think is usually what you get. One other thing about this is that most behavior is learned. The good news about that is that if it's been learned, it can be unlearned and something else can be learned in its place. If it's not being helpful, if it's not positive, it's not easy, but you can work at changing it. So it's that self-talk. What do we say to ourselves? How do I listen? How many of you were at the session on couple communication last night that talked about the awareness wheel? To be able to think about what information we've gotten through the senses, and when we think about really what's going on, then we can listen how we're going to feel about it, and then deciding what we want and how we're going to put it into action. We've got lots of opportunity there and lots of responsibility there. Sometimes we don't want to take it, it's just too much, and we let other people decide. Well, let's go on to number three, accept yourself and smile. It does a couple of things, especially if you can accept yourself and you can smile. It encourages that I'm okay feeling within you, and it also makes other people wonder what's really going on. What you're really up to. In a sense, we're really all winners here. In graduate school, I used to be a teaching assistant to Saul Gordon, who did a lot of work in sexuality. And we would have classes of 300 people at Syracuse University in Syracuse, New York. And he would break them up by saying, "You're all winners here. Every one of you, you're all winners. You are the one and the 6 million that was created by that sperm. If it would have been any other sperm that met that ovum, you would have been a different person. You might have been someone else. So you're all winners. You were created you." And all those 5,999,999 are just off. I mean, they aren't winners. You are the winner. So you can always think, when you feel rather lost and not very successful, you can say, "But I'm a winner. I won the sperm race." So, you're a winner. So when others tell you things, "You can't ever, why don't you?" To be able to turn around, what can you say to yourself? And that gets us into this next one. The up until now, but I want you to try another exercise. And as we look at being the winner, to be able to say, "I'm enough." So let's try that. 1, 2, 3, go. "I'm enough." Again. "I'm enough." Again. "I'm enough." We're okay. Try that. I mean, after you do the "I'm enough." Up until now, when we find that there are some times that we've done some things or have been labeled in a certain way, you can always tell yourself, "Up until now, yeah, I did. I can always make a change at this point. I don't have to continue. I can start anew." It's been one of the most helpful phrases I've learned in the last 10 years, the "up until now." That there's always the possibility of change. It's a way to break out of the cycle. It's a way to get rid of the negative thoughts. It's a way to introduce more positive thoughts and more positive actions within you. I think it's Jack Canfield, who does a lot of work on self-esteem, it says, when you say, "I'm sick and tired of this," you tell your unconscious mind what to think. So, for instance, you say, "I'm sick and tired," you become sick and tired. A powerful person probably will say, "I won't stand for this," and doesn't become sick and tired. Well, I'm not sure how this actually happens, but it's a positive thought, not to say, "I'm sick and tired and I just can't do anything more with this, but I won't stand for this, or I'm not going to deal with it," up until now, and set it aside. Jack Canfield goes on to say that your unconscious mind takes in everything you say as a command. And I suppose you can go to the extreme and you can say, okay, I'll eat a piece of cake, and every time I eat a piece of cake, it goes straight to my hips. And your unconscious mind says, "Eat cake, go straight to hips." Now, if we want to be more positive about it, you can say, "Every time I eat a piece of cake, I get burned up as energy." Your unconscious mind says, "Eat cake, burn up as energy, and go." Well, give that a try. See how positive, how it can help you toward more positive thinking and accepting. And being able to work on that which you are not the happiest in accepting in yourself. There's always parts of us that we haven't really done some conscious thinking about, and we've gotten into the habit of going along doing such and such a thing, which might be rather sloppy or not in our best interest or not in somebody else, either ours or somebody else's best interest. And until you stop to think, is that really me? Is that really what I want to do? And then you can always come in with the, up until now, this has been my pattern, but I can change. So we can monitor those thoughts and replace them with the up until now statements. And it's really, so often we think of it's external events that determine the outcome for you. But it's not just external events, it's also our outlook on those that equals what's the response going to be, or the outcome in my life, and how I'm going to deal about it. So, up until now, got another exercise for you to try with this as we look at those changes and how what we say to ourselves affects what happens within us. And for those, I think you've all got enough room, I want you all to hunch over. Put your head down by your knees and to say, I really feel great. Okay, I really feel great. Are you convincing yourself that you feel great? I really feel great. Okay, let's try it the other way. Let's go back up and put your hands in the air and say, I'm depressed. I'm depressed.
I'm depressed.
Huh? What's wrong there?
Something,
okay. Body language. Body language is totally off. How do we convince ourselves that you're depressed in a winning kind of body language? Or to be happy when you're really down. Now, maybe there are some times where you've got a headache or you're really trying to think that you might go down and put your hand, your head in your hands and hands on the knees and really think, or if you just want to relax your back. But that's hardly a way to express that you feel great. Greatness needs some. People watching around the village. And sometimes you see some people and they walk along with such carriage and such a smile on their face, and you think, wow. I want to know what they're eating. Since my husband has been teaching at the seminary, we belong to a local congregation, and on occasion he'll do the service. And last, because our pastor has several services on Christmas Eve, Paul has regularly offered to take the Christmas morning service, so he doesn't have to do so many sermons in preparation. And we were at the service. I was assisting him actually, and when he walked out, the wife of the former chair of the council walked up. The former chair of the council walked up to Paul and said, my wife leaned over to me toward the end of the service and said, I don't know what Paul Bosch has had for breakfast this morning, but I want some. Because it was just a great day, and he was just... His tone of voice and what he's preached on and his whole manner was just so very positive. And I thought that was, I don't know what they're eating, but I want some of it to be positive like that. We can't create a psychological state that's associated with victory by being in a depressed position. And you can't create an exhilarating state by using negative statements. So we want to be able to watch what we're saying to ourselves as well. We can shift states and we can take responsibility for these. Okay, let's go on to the next. 5, to encourage yourself. How often do you do that? When you do something wrong, when you do something that doesn't work out, it's not wrong, when you do something that doesn't work out the way you wanted it to, what do you often say to yourself? Or what do you hear other people say to themselves?
I'm so dumb.
That's so dumb. What else?
I knew it.
I knew it. And what is that really saying? I was going to fail. I was going to louse up. Things wouldn't work out. We had that negative prediction instead of a, well, something didn't work out. They tell the story about Thomas Edison, and that a friend said to him, how did you manage to keep on working on the light bulb? 1,400 failures. And Edison said, no. It wasn't 1,400 failures. It was a 1,400-step process. I learned something from each of those tasks that helped me to overcome the difficulties with that and go on to the next. How often do we ever say that to ourselves? Well, that's not the way I wanted that project to turn out. Now, what didn't work out right? That would be a very positive way of looking at it. It would be like your, how many have children here? You remember how many times they fell down before they started to walk? I mean, if they fell down the first time they tried to walk and they fell on their bum and they said, that's it, forget it, you're not going to try to walk again, you're going to stick in that stroller, that's it. I mean, how many of us would be pushed around in strollers and wheelchairs at this time because we failed that first step? Fortunately, we give a lot of encouragement at that time. And it's like one father who said, as we were talking about this kind of encouragement that we give children, that we often do very well in those early years. We encourage them to talk, we encourage them to walk, and then they do some more talking, and they do some more walking, and we tell them to shut up and sit down. And we stop that further encouraging. So how do we encourage ourselves? How many of you keep a victory log or a success journal? How many of you keep a journal of any sort? Great.
Accomplishments at work.
They tell a story about the man, the CEO of Levi Strauss, you know, the jeans, all these, that he keeps an ordinary secretary steno book, you know, a little spiral at the top. He probably could have the most expensive leather-bound blank page book that you could find, but he keeps an ordinary steno book on his desk, and he writes down all of his successes, all his victories, such as got my son to clean up his room, got my daughter to run the washing machine, opened up markets in China, got a $5 million, I mean, he mixes both personal and professional things together, and that everybody in his office knows that when he goes to start a new deal or to work on, reach out to a new market, he goes back through his little book and he flips and reads the successes. It says, I can do it. I'm a success. I'm enough. How do we keep track of our successes? One of the exercises I like to have people in my self-esteem class do is to think of your age. And if, for instance, you happen to be 45, divide it into thirds. So the first 15 years, the second 15 years, the third 15 years. You know, whatever. And think of five successes you've had in each of those sets, each of those thirds of your life. Do that for just a quick minute right now. Think of some successes. How many successes can you come up with in the last 15 years, in the middle 15 years, and in the first 15 years? Finished first, second, third, fourth, fifth grade. That's one set. How many of you had any difficulty in that very quick time? Didn't give you much time to think about it, but that's another thing. We think of what we wanted to do that may not have worked out. Sometimes, oh no, that's not enough of a success. We qualify what we might register as success. But as the CEO of Levi Strauss, a success to him was getting his teenager to clean his room. That's a success. Now, we may not have that success that runs through for the next 6 months every day, but if you do it once, I mean, think of that. We often think it's got to be a great, huge success without thinking there's little pieces. Rejoice in those. Encourage those. And if we can remind ourselves, yes?
Part of that could be positive attitude, too.
Sure. the positive attitude that says, just for today, I'll look at this, rather than, I know it's not going to last tomorrow, so why even bother? And we're already negative when tomorrow hasn't even come. So don't make your expectations too large. Take them in small pieces and be grateful for each little piece that works out, that will build. Not 1,400 failures, but a 1,400-step process. How is it working out? What are your strengths? And what are you working toward? And I suppose in this we might also become aware of what do we do to block ourselves? I tend to procrastinate. I just tend to think, oh, it may not be quite good enough. And I don't have enough time to really make it good, so I won't do it right now. I'll do it. And then all of a sudden, I've got to rush and do it. Or we tell ourselves, oh, nothing ever works out right. Or somebody else can do it, but not me. No, I can't. So to get in touch with what our strengths are, and also if we get in touch, in a sense like it's saying, what's the best thing that can happen? What's the worst that can happen? But there's a third question to ask, and that's, what can I do to prevent the worst from happening? So you look at possibilities, you look at choices, you look at breaking it down and making it in small enough pieces that you can work with it in accomplishing what it is you want to accomplish. And sometimes it's helpful if you have a good friend, a partner, or a family member that you feel good about, to ask them to write down a list of strengths. I have a kind of surrogate daughter back in Waterloo who is living, she's as old as my older daughter, actually. And she's pretty much on the outside of her family. Her father has been an alcoholic and is now in a halfway house. Her mother has moved out to another province. And she's sort of alone and is working through some things, and someone suggested to her that she write out a list of her strengths. She says, and asked if she could come up with a list of 15 strengths. And she was over at our house one evening watching a video, and when it was over, we started talking about this, and she said, I can only get to 12. And so she started talking about what those strengths were, and I said, but I also see you doing this, and see you doing this, and see you doing this. That she thinks of herself very much as an introvert, but she's often at our house when other people come in, and she's one that often begins a conversation. Very appropriate, I mean, not off the wall. She has a nice manner about herself, and she gets people talking. And I've been really impressed about this, and I guess I hadn't said it to her before. And she says, oh, do I? And so we began to talk about a couple of recent situations when this happened, and she had another one to put down. And we, you know, so sometimes it's helpful to see how other people see you positively. That can encourage and support yourself. Well, let's look at number 6. We have a few more minutes. To speak for yourself, to use I messages. Not you make me, or you shouldn't have, but I feel, and I would like, or I need, or I really appreciate. How do we give that encouragement to somebody else? We need to be able to encourage ourselves. It's like putting the oxygen mask on first to say, hey, I'm okay, and then it's easier to say to somebody else, you're okay too. We can support each other. How many of you grew up with a registered psychic as a parent? Anyone? No?
Yeah.
Okay. They had a crystal.
Why are you doing that?
Yeah, I know why you're doing that. And they've got eyes in the back of the heads and sides as well, and they're around the corner, they can see around the corner. We tend to think that that's what our parents really have. And it's probably because they knew what they did in those situations themselves, and you're probably going to try it too. It's probably more thinking about their own experience than really knowing what you're going to do. How many of you have a crystal ball that can tell you what somebody else needs, or even what you need? Well, since we don't have registered psychics abundantly, And we don't have a lot of crystal balls that can really tell us what somebody else is thinking or needing and what even I'm thinking and needing some of the time. It may be helpful for me to say what I need. Ask to clarify what I think might be going on to you. That'll come into the next one. Jack Canfield also says in this that we need to ask. Sometimes we're so afraid of asking for what we need or asking for some information. Any of you read Deborah Tanner's book on, is it You Just Don't Understand? Is that the correct title of it?
No.
There's two, you're combining the two titles. Yeah. It's in the bookstore, and it's very interesting. Deborah Tanner. And that typically men are uncomfortable, I'm generalizing, it's not everyone, but it's more common among men that it's uncomfortable to ask for directions. And in her research and studies, she's come up with a theory, how accurate or inaccurate, only men can probably let us know, that in most relationships for men, it's a one up and a one down. One is a winner, one is a loser. And so when they have to go and ask a simple question of somebody, they feel like they're one down, and the other may be the person up. And even if the other person doesn't know where that street is or the direction that they ought to go, they'll probably make it up. Because they don't want to be one down saying, gee, I don't know. So you never can trust. You never can trust what the information the other person is going to give you. So why even bother? Well, it may make some sense. But so talk about that sometime. And that it may happen with women too. To speak up and to ask for what you need and to work through that information that's needed to share with each other. And the second part of that that goes with the I messages is to listen, to check out what you hear, so that you know that the idea you may have in your head is accurate or not. Because we often come up with making a decision for somebody else. And we assume that we know what the other person's thinking. And it may be off the wall or it may be right on, but we don't know. And whenever we do that, we tend to make an ass out of both you and me. Because it may not be correct. And I don't think any of us really want to do that intentionally. And so it's very helpful. And it's like another, for better or for worse, cartoon that has... it's Adam, the house husband, the house father. And it's Thanksgiving time, and mom, who is working, is saying, oh, we've got people coming for Thanksgiving. We don't have any food. Now you have to go and get some butter. We're out of butter. And we've got to get some cranberry sauce, and we've got to get some... And he's saying... butter, okay. Oh, cranberry sauce, and I want the chunky kind, not the smooth kind. And he says, peanut butter, chunky. And he says something else, and she says, did you hear me? And he says, yes. He doesn't say, yes, chunky peanut butter, and da-da-da-da-da-da. But did you hear me? Yes. So you should know what the other person's going. But they each have different ideas about what it is. So we need to check out. Chunky peanut butter with that turkey is going to taste mighty funny instead of the cranberry sauce. So we don't assume. Since we don't have the crystal ball and we're not registered psychics, we can't really guess. We can't really know. We can guess. But that's only a guess until I check it out. Do you mean? I wonder if you're feeling such and such, or it sounds like, is that something that you really want to check out? And then the very last skill is, no matter, it's a reminder to ourselves, no matter what you say or do to me, I'm still a worthwhile person. God doesn't make junk. Remember, you can't learn less. Ever thought about that? something happens, you can always learn what went well, so you can repeat it again, what didn't work out right, so you can change it, and to know the difference. You can't learn less. And no matter what someone says to you, you're still a worthwhile person. Well, that's some basics and some eight skills on taking care of myself. Are there any questions or comments about what we've just covered? Want to read a declaration of self-esteem that will close then by Virginia Satir. Virginia Satir is a therapist who has done a lot of helpful work in family therapy. And this is a declaration that we might each want to say and to think about. My declaration of self-esteem: I am me. In all the world, there was no one else exactly like me. There are persons who have some parts like me, but no one adds up exactly like me. Therefore, everything that comes out of me is authentically mine, because I alone choose it. I own everything about me: my body, including everything it does, including all its thoughts and ideas; my eyes, including the images of all they behold; my feelings, whatever they may be, anger, joy, frustration, love, disappointment, excitement; my mouth and all the words that come out of it, polite, sweet or rough, correct or incorrect; my voice, loud or soft, and all my actions, whether they be to others or to myself. I own my fantasies, my dreams, my hopes, my fears. I own all my triumphs and successes, all my failures and mistakes. Because I own all of me, I can become intimately acquainted with me. By so doing, I can love me and be friendly with me in all my parts. I can then make it possible for all of me to work in my best interests. I know there are aspects about myself that puzzle me, and other aspects I do not know, but as long as I'm friendly and loving to myself, I can courageously and hopefully look for the solutions to the puzzles and for the ways to find out more about me. However I look and sound, whatever I say and do, and whatever I think and feel at a given moment in time is me. This is authentic and represents where I am at that moment in time. When I review later how I looked and sounded, what I said and did, and how I thought and felt, some parts may turn out to be unfitting. I can discard that which is unfitting and keep that which proved fitting and invent something new for that which I discarded. I can see, hear, feel, think, say, and do. I have the tools to survive, to be close to others, to be productive, and to make sense and order out of the world of people and things outside of me. I own me, and therefore I can engineer me. I am me, and I am okay. And so are you. Thank you.